I'm Artie Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. In my many decades in the workforce, I have never heard a worker say, "Gosh, I really wish we had more meetings." Employee surveys have shown time and again that most workers want fewer meetings, some even willing to forgo a 10% raise for it. The problem? Meetings take up a lot of time, often lack focus and a clear agenda, deal with issues that could be solved via email or text, are dominated by the biggest and loudest talkers. I could go on with a litany of complaints. So today on Radio Times, the problem with meetings and how to fix it. Also, what we learned in the last year of remote work about virtual Zoom meetings, and we want to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. We have two guests who have joined us. Sidal Neely is professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, author of Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. She joined us by Skype. And Sidal Neely, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm thrilled to be with you today.
Well, we're thrilled to have you as well. Also with us is Stephen Rogelberg. He's a professor of organizational science, psychology, and management at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, author of The Surprising Science of Meetings. And Stephen Rogelberg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. It's really my pleasure.
Nice to have you with us. And let me put the first most obvious question to both of you. I'll start with you, Sidal Neely. Do you hate meetings?
I hate unnecessary meetings, which is they're plentiful. If meetings fit the objective, the collaboration efforts, the time that you need to be together in real time to achieve goals, then they're fabulous. But meetings for the sake of meetings are not productive.
And are most meetings that happen across the business world meetings for the sake of meetings from your perspective?
I think there are many meetings for the sake of meetings, or people's natural responses is to say, okay, let's have a meeting to talk about this. Or I want to prepare you for a conversation. Let's meet before we have an actual meeting. Have you seen those? It's like the meeting before the meeting. It's like, wait, can we do this asynchronously? So people don't have sufficient use of technologies or more repertoires on how to communicate. So the reflex, the default is meetings. And I think that if we are more thoughtful about when and how we meet, I think work could be smoother, we would be more efficient, and there'd be much more efficacy.
Well, I want to get to all of that. Stephen Rogelberg, let me get you in on the conversation. Do you hate meetings?
Do I hate meetings? Well, I like the meetings that I lead. Those I seem to enjoy quite a bit.
Okay, we'll get to that, but go ahead.
You know, I'm actually really lucky. So yes, I am not the biggest fan of attending meetings, but after writing a book on leveraging science to make meetings better, basically what I found is it puts pressure on everyone who's in a meeting with me to kind of rise up a little bit. So I have to admit, one of the added benefits of writing this book is the meetings I attend are much better than they used to be.
Is that because you're a better leader of meetings?
Well, I think it just, it kind of creates this implicit pressure, right? That I don't think people want, they're fearful that if they're in a meeting with me, that next thing they know, that meeting is going to be the focus of my next article. Oh. So I just think that people want to lead meetings a little bit more thoughtfully.
Well, let me ask you both, and I'll go back to you, Sidal Neely, which is to look back over the last year, not that there aren't remote meetings happening even as we speak, but this was this surprise experiment that not we all, but people that worked largely in offices had to go through in the last year, dealing with a pandemic and being forced home and having meetings via Zoom at all. How did we do with that? What did we learn from that, Sidal Neely?
It's interesting because since COVID hit March 2020, what I've observed and talking to many people across companies, organizations, work is that people adopted video conferencing at a very fast rate to hold meetings, right? We say Zoom, but there are other video tools that people use, and they started to have edge-to-edge meetings, so from one meeting to the next, without building in transition time, without building in work time in order to fulfill the to-dos that came from those meetings. And then at the end of the day, people were so tired. They call it tech exhaustion, they call it Zoom fatigue, and that's because they're not only meeting too much, they're meeting edge-to-edge, and on top of that, using video conferencing. So now we're at a place where we're trying to recalibrate and reduce the amount of video conferencing that people hold so that this Zoom or tech exhaustion disappears.
And to you, Stephen Rogelberg, the same question, which is, what did we learn from a year of remote, either virtual or Zoom Teams, that, you know, there are many tools that we use. What do we learn from that about meetings?
Sure. Great question. And so I've been tracking virtual meeting effectiveness throughout COVID, been doing it globally. And what we're actually finding is that virtual meeting effectiveness is improving. People are getting better at it. And in fact, virtual meeting as a modality perhaps is more conducive to effective meetings when done properly, mm-hmm. right? So virtual meetings do provide some additional opportunities that we don't have in face-to-face meetings. For example, the chat function. So one of the things that we found in our chat function is that, especially in larger meetings, it provides this wonderful alternative approach for increasing communication richness, but it appears to be leveraged more by those who tend to be a little bit lower in power and status in the meetings. So in this particular example, chat serves as an additional vehicle for voice and inclusion.
So the idea of these virtual meetings actually empowered people that maybe in a face-to-face meeting would not feel so emboldened to speak up. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So what I'm saying is that virtual meetings that allows for some additional opportunities to elevate the meeting experience. Now, it's going to be really the leader's values and motivations to leverage all these tools.
Right.
But in and of itself, virtual meetings have some unique advantages, be it, you know, no head of table effects, right? People are distributed equally. You know, the use of chat, the use of breakouts, the use of anonymous polling, the use of virtual blackboards, like all these things have the potential to make virtual meetings more effective than face-to-face meetings.
Professor Neely, let me go back to you. And you mentioned, and perhaps this happened more during the pandemic when everyone was so scattered and so leaders felt like, oh, we need to meet so that we're together. Was that the problem during the pandemic, back-to-back-to-back-to-back meetings, and then people were exhausted by 6 o'clock at night?
You know, I think it was just part of the learning curve. And I completely agree with Steve in that virtual meetings give people a lot of opportunity, it democratizes, but it's also very easy to launch, right? So I just think that people just started meeting and trying to, in a way, replicate what they used to do face to face and realized, wait a minute, I could even have more meetings when I'm in this remote fashion. So the process by which they would arrange meetings got people in trouble. But there's also so many things that people need to learn, which is why I love hearing Steve when it comes to meetings. When it comes to the use of digital tools. And in fact, there is some 50 years worth of research that talk about which digital tools are appropriate for what type of work. Mm. Instead, the patterns that we were seeing is that people would completely over-index on video conferencing meetings as opposed to using asynchronous modalities to get work done. And that's been one of the biggest things that they needed to understand. And there are other dimensions as well. You know, some media are lean, like an email is considered to be lean media because it doesn't convey emotions, context, space. And some other, doesn't convey nonverbal language. On the other end, rich media, like video conferencing, provides all those things. But not everything requires context and emotions and nonverbal language. A simple email sometimes will do. And those are the things that people need to learn more of as we begin to use so many more digital tools to convene and to work, whether we're virtual or not, by the way.
Well, let me go back to you, Professor Rogelberg, which is now we're at a position, a time when more where I'm at work, as are my producers. So we have this interesting combination, if we're going to have meetings, where it might be mixed, where some people are in person and some people are remote. How do we take these tools so that everyone is equal when it comes to the meeting? Or, you know, some people probably the leader more equal than others. But, you know, how do we make that work?
Sure. So first of all, I really like Dr. Neely's comments. I really, you know, one of the things that, you know, we found is the kind of the definition of an excellent meeting leader is someone who fundamentally embraces their role as a steward of others' time, right? So this notion of being a good steward makes you very aware of what you're asking people to do and how they spend their time. And so a good steward also is careful in picking the right tools for the challenge ahead. And so I like this idea of thinking about synchronous and asynchronous. I think that's a real opportunity for meeting leaders. Now, with regard to your specific question around, you know, kind of
hybrid, I guess is hybrid, the word, right?
It's really interesting. So our research on hybrid meetings is not looking so good. That basically meeting effectiveness ratings of hybrid meetings appear to be the lowest. And for those individuals who attend the meeting remote, their experience appears to be quite different than everyone else. Namely, those people tend to disengage, they tend not to feel as included, they tend to multitask. So basically, to no big surprise, in a hybrid meeting, those people who are face-to-face tend to be privileged in the conversation in comparison to those attending remote.
And we're almost up at a break here. Is that because the leader, the person managing the meeting just pays more attention to the person in front of them?
Exactly. I mean, our conference rooms are not thoughtfully designed to really draw in remote individuals. And there are ways of doing that. There are ways of redesigning and rethinking our conference rooms to allow for more, to counter the bias of out of sight, out of mind. And that's really what tends to happen in these hybrid meetings.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about meetings. We love them. We don't love them. We have to go to them. How to make them better. That's Stephen Rogelberg. He's a professor of organizational science, psychology, and management at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte, author of The Surprising Science of Meetings. Also with us is Sidal Neely, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, author of Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about meetings, the bane of so many workers' existence. We'll be talking about how to run a good meeting, how to make them a productive use of time, also why there are too many meetings and how to make them shorter. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Professor Neely, let me ask you, sort of, we've been talking about the problem of meetings. What does a well-run meeting look like? What does it sound like? What is the vibe in the room? What are people doing that makes it a good meeting?
First of all, a good meeting has an agenda that's very clear, not only articulated through the time of the meeting, but people can anticipate what's going to happen in that meeting and that their contributions are important to advance whatever goals we have for the meeting. So if it's just a straight information transfer or knowledge transfer, that's uninteresting. People check out, and in a virtual environment, the multitasking begins. But if it's the kind of meeting where everyone's knowledge, background is needed to advance the goals, people are really into it. The second thing is the length of meetings are really important to think about. Meetings tend to be too long. And in the last 14, 15 months, we've seen this kind of meeting creep for even conversations that need to be shorter. The other thing is it's important to make sure that the conversation is inclusive. So leaders need to ensure that the dominant people are dialed down. Those who tend to be quiet, perhaps because of lower status, need help to get dialed up. And the leader's job is to ensure that they're balancing inclusion throughout. And there are different ways to do that. For example, inviting those who have lower tenure in that group, you know, recently joined, to make a comment first so that others are not dominating. And having a proper close to the meeting is another thing, to figure out what are we going to do, what are our next steps as a result of this conversation. And last thing I'll say is meetings should not always be thought of as a one discrete event. It's one meeting that can be paired with a follow-up summary, email, something on the internal social media to capture the conversation so that there's continuity. So pairing digital tools or technologies or various modalities with actual meetings can also make the overall work more effective.
A quick follow-up question. What's your definition of a too long meeting?
I think an hour, 90 minutes could be too long if you only need 30.
And I guess the
depends on your objective. Right. It depends on your objective. I've had many 20-minute meetings that were fantastic. You know, people will take as much time as they need. But of course, you have to make sure that you think about timing based on the number of people that you have in the group so that people do have equal opportunity for airtime as well. But 45 minutes for a meeting is fantastic with a 15-minute transition if you should have another meeting to follow.
Sure. Stephen Rogelberg, let me turn to you. And I saw some research you did that, that people leading meetings often think that they are better than the attendees who attend those meetings. Help us understand that disconnect.
Yes. So that was actually my joke that I made earlier, that I like the meetings that I lead, really stems from that bias. That what we find is that meeting leaders have a blind spot of sorts. That if you survey people immediately following a meeting and you ask them how good that meeting was, most attendees will say, oh, that was really not that great. That wasn't that engaging. That wasn't really well run. But if you survey the leader, their perception tends to be much more positive. And if you really think about it, that's not a big surprise, right? They're in control, right? Everyone else is relinquishing their control. The meeting leader gets to talk a lot. So control and talking a lot, these are things that kind of make you feel like you're having a good experience. And this blind spot is important, right? Because when you have this blind spot, then your appetite for making positive changes or for deep reflection tends to be mitigated. And thus the meeting problem just perpetuates itself over time.
Well, let me ask you then, for leaders, how can they educate themselves on how attendees are actually in real time responding to what's going on in the meeting? I'm thinking about some of those, you know, more subtle, sometimes not so subtle, body language, you know, how people fold their arms or maybe sneak look at their cell phone. How can leaders be better educated about what they're doing?
That's a great question. And so first of all, obviously we can do an informal scan, right? We can kind of get a, you know, take a look at the meeting dynamics. If you're, as leader, you're the one talking all the time, that's probably a bad sign. And then there's more formal mechanisms. So if you go back to this comment I made earlier about being a good steward of time, well, a good steward also is willing to ask people who regularly attend their meetings how things are going, right? So it's very, it's a stewardship act to survey your folks periodically where you ask them what's going well with our meetings, not so well, and what can we do better, right? That's kind of like the ultimate act of stewardship because you're allowing other voices to help you on your journey to make these things the best they can be. I mean, right now, the research suggests there's around 100 million meetings a day around the globe. This is an incredible amount of activity. So every individual leader has a responsibility to take their slice and make sure their own house is in order. And by soliciting this feedback formally, they have this opportunity. And I'll add one last thing. I work with a number of organizations to try to create, to change their meeting ecosystem, to make meeting feedback part of that ecosystem. So for example, it's very typical for organizations to have engagement surveys, right? But if you examine the content on engagement surveys, there's basically nothing on meetings. And this is an incredible blind spot for organizations, right? How can we possibly expect us to maximize this incredible investment of time and resources if leaders are never given any feedback or if there's never any accountability?
Well, let me pick up on that. And Sidhal Neely, let me turn this back to you. How many leaders have been trained to run a meeting that actually know what it takes to manage a meeting that is productive and a use of people's time and it gives room for give and take?
I think there are few formally trained managers who think about meetings in the way that we just heard. And that's a shame because a lot of work gets done through meetings. Now, because my area of work includes global work and virtual work, in that arena, I do get a lot of folks who want some of the tips and the best practices because they're somewhat different, right? They require some understanding of time zones and timing. And how do you have an effective conversation, particularly across boundaries, because you're also bringing in kind of this cross-cultural variable as well. But besides that, it's absolutely correct. We spend very little time understanding meetings, how to do them well, providing and receiving feedback in order to improve them. We just take them for granted, and we just keep having more and more of them.
Well, and, you know, it's hard to hear negative feedback, Professor Neely.
It is indeed, but it's not negative feedback because I'll tell you, there are many leaders who would probably throw a parade if they realized their people wanted less meetings. I mean, I cannot think except, you know, for maybe the handful of folks who feel like their self-esteem is enhanced through meetings. I can't think of too many people who think that the amount of meetings that they're required or requiring of themselves is adequate. People often think that they're having too many meetings. And sometimes you don't talk about it. You think it's just the way we do things.
Right. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. That's Sidhal Neely. She's a professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Stephen Rogelberg is with us as well. He's a professor of organizational science, psychology, and management at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And we are talking about meetings and what to do about them. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us 1-888-477-9499. Here's a tweet from Surav. The person hosting a meeting should control the time. Human beings' minds won't be focused for more than 50 minutes, so don't drag any meeting beyond that time. Stephen Rogelberg, if I can toss that first to you. And I mean, we are talking about time, and time is valuable. 50 minutes, does that seem like a max?
For most purposes, it is. The research shows there's something called Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law is this idea that work expands to fill whatever time is allotted to it. So if a meeting is scheduled for an hour, magically it will take an hour. But this also means that if a meeting is scheduled for 30 minutes, it will take 30 minutes. And in fact, research shows that when teams are under moderate levels of pressure in their meetings, they actually perform more optimally. There's more focus, right? So when we think about meeting times a little bit more strategically and just don't default to the hour-long meeting, I think there's some incredible opportunities to give people back the greatest gift in the world, time, and make our meetings better. And I do want to add one other thing that is kind of a potential innovation for elevating the time and getting that focus is when you think about agendas, most agendas are framed as a set of topics to be discussed. And what I advocate is at times, frame your agenda as a set of questions to be answered.
I like that.
And by framing as a set of questions to be answered, now the meeting leader really has to think about what they're trying to achieve. And then it could go back to some of Dr. Neely's comments where perhaps they say, you know what, a meeting is not needed. We could use an alternative modality. By framing your agenda as a set of questions, you have a better sense of who really has to be there. And by framing your agenda as a set of questions, you really know if the meeting has been successful, right? Because the questions have been answered. And on top of this all, questions serve as goals, and they allow people to focus more and address those needs. And once those needs are met, the meeting's over.
Professor Neely, let me. I have a feeling you want to respond to what Stephen Rogelberg just said, but let me read first a comment from Bill, who writes, for organizations that deal with the public, like stores, hospitals, museums, and government offices, meetings are a welcome break. There are free snacks and coffee. People pretend to listen to you, and you get something often rare in your world, an hour or so off your feet. I mean, Bill's on to something, wouldn't you say?
Oh, completely, completely. I was referring to different type of work where people feel like we need to meet constantly. I'm talking about, you know, when we're binging on meetings as opposed to the meetings that are, the type of meeting that is just described here. That, I think, is a great thing. In fact, maybe you want more of those, which is informative. But what I was referring to is just this tendency to want to meet when you can email, to want to meet when you can send a Slack message, to want to meet when you can just write a note that people can share on Google Docs. So it's really about evaluating, do we need to meet to do this work? I keep thinking and talking about, and this is based on research, decades of research, that the question that we should be asking ourselves is, what do we need in order to achieve this work goal? Do we need to communicate in a meeting? Yes, no. And then move from there. But I completely agree with what we just heard. It's important as a different element of people's work.
Here's another comment. This one from Dan. Employers do not recognize that they are paying for people to be in meetings. Their time and expense could be better spent doing other work. Also, another bane is copying everyone on emails. It can be a tremendous waste of time. Senders should send emails only to those for whom it matters. We've done whole shows on emails, but talking about meetings, I mean, it is, and I'm back to you, Stephen Rogelberg. It is time, and time is money when it comes to the workplace.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think a sub-theme for a lot of my comments, right, so we've talked about stewardship, and we've touched upon blind spot. And the blind spot exists at so many levels. So we have the blind spot for the individual leader, but we have so many blind spots with regard to the organization, right? When you think about the tremendous investment they're making, I mean, meetings are the largest cost expenditure that goes unexamined on an organization's balance sheet. And that's not even including opportunity costs where people could be doing something else in that time period. So, you know, what we need to do is stop complaining about meetings and really start to think of them as an opportunity for competitive advantage. And they are, because if you're an organization that can figure this out and start implementing meaningful practices culturally and provide meaningful and robust training to your leaders, right, you truly have this opportunity to elevate your organization and do what so many other organizations aren't doing, which is to make your meetings truly work.
Dr. Neely, I was reading about something called meeting recovery syndrome. I mean, I think it was used a bit ironically. Can you expand on that?
Meeting recovery syndrome. What do you mean by that? I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, actually, okay. Well, actually, let me toss that to you. That's you. Yeah. Let me toss that to you, Stephen Vogelberg.
No worries. Sorry, Dr. Neely. I didn't want to leave
you
there.
I feel like I need this, though. I'm like listening.
I think we all do, but go ahead. Go ahead.
What we have found in our research is that when you have a bad meeting, you just don't leave it at the physical or virtual door. It sticks with you. You ruminate on it, and you often co-ruminate on it. And what we have found further in our research is that when you have a bad meeting, you actually, your performance and productivity following that meeting decreases. And so that's this whole notion of meeting recovery syndrome, is that there really, that there appears to be, it takes time to get over a bad meeting experience.
Does that make sense to you, Professor Neely?
100%, which is why what we find, particularly in kind of this virtual or distributed work environment, people tend to pair their communication with others in order to do some of that, to use your term, recovery, in that if you've had a terrible meeting, you might want to follow up with an email or something in order to do some repair work there. Not leaving those things hanging, but finding ways to use different media to make things better. And typically the pairing tends to be a meeting to some form of asynchronous modality paired together around the same topic so that you can move on from the particulars of that meeting.
And that is Sidal Neely, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, author of Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. Also with us, Stephen Rogelberg, professor of organizational science, psychology, and management at the University of North Carolina. His book is The Surprising Science of Meetings. And yes, we are talking about meetings, how to have better meetings, fewer meetings. And again, you can join our conversation. Interested in your perspective on this, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the problem with meetings, how to make them work better, some of the lessons that we learned from over a year of virtual meetings. And we've got two guests, Professor Sidal Neely and Stephen Rogelberg. Professor Neely, let me go back to you and get a little bit inside the dynamics of meetings. First of all, do men still tend to dominate meetings, interrupt more in meetings?
Yes, they
do.
Hey,
let me answer that.
Stephen, yeah, exactly. I get it. No, you have to be quiet. Us girls are going to talk. Go ahead, Professor Neely.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exhibit A. No, go ahead.
And men tend to dominate more, and in a global context, Americans tend to dominate more. And so when I say that leaders have to work so hard to ensure that some have to dial down, some have to dial up and work hard to balance for inclusion, it's around issues of status and power and gender and also junior versus senior. And so, but I've learned that if you have norms, articulated norms on the rules of engagement during these meetings that leaders share with the rest of the members of that particular team, people do tend to behave, but you've got to point it out. Otherwise, it just happens naturally that some members will dominate others.
Well, I wonder, Stephen Rogelberg, whether that requires modeling on the part of the leader, and how do you, in a sense, shut someone down who is dominating and interrupting and doing all those disruptive things?
Yeah, it's great. So, I mean, certainly the meeting leader's behaviors can quickly, implicitly become normative. So the things that leader says and does, people will take cues for that. And so a meeting leader who actively facilitates, you know, can raise the energy of others. So I'm a big believer that if you can increase the energy of others, it's the natural counter mechanism to those dominating individuals, right? So if that person, if the leading meeting leader is active and saying, you know, Sasha, I'd love to hear from you. Lainey, do you agree with this? I know you've been doing some work on that, right? So you can just imagine if that's the type of discourse the meeting leader's doing, well, they're creating a completely different dynamic. Another thing, just to kind of completely go out of the box, is I know Dr. Neely, this will be very aligned with her thoughts, is basically, you know, we could think about running meetings at times a little differently. For example, you know, we often think that, you know, a meeting should be done verbally, but we can actually conduct meetings silently. Huh. And the research on silence in meetings is fabulous. So let me give you an example of what that could look like. Basically, what the research shows that if you compare groups who brainstorm with their mouths versus groups brainstorming in silence, just typing into a document or using an app, the groups that brainstorm in silence tend to generate nearly twice as many ideas, and those ideas tend to be more innovative and creative. And the reason being is, you know, there's no waiting your turn. Everyone, in a sense, can talk at once. You know, furthermore, because there's a simultaneous generation of ideas, you're not editing your ideas based on, you know, this more linear progression of ideas. So by using silence in meetings at times, you actually increase the loudness of so many voices. And thus, there's not that opportunity for that one or two individuals to dominate. And then once those ideas emerge via silence, you know, now the meeting, you know, has to talk about them.
Well, that's so fascinating. What do you think about silence in meetings, Professor Neely?
I think that's brilliant. That's brilliant and consistent with the idea of using multiple channels like the chat and other things in order to promote not only that everyone participates, but at the same time, you're also giving people time or what we call sometimes the delay that they need in order to think through their best ideas to bring forward. So it's consistent with the idea of using multiple channels, of giving time people time to think before they share their ideas. Sometimes even in order to get energy going, you tell people to take a piece of paper, to write down their thoughts, and then you begin to invite people to articulate them out loud. That creates a lot of buzz, a lot of energy. You might also put people in breakout groups before they begin discussing them, or if it's a physical meeting, an in-person meeting, you have them a quick you encourage them to have a quick conversation about their idea with their neighbor, the person sitting next to them, and then you open it up. It's a very energetic conversation, and great ideas do show up.
Well, we've got a lot of people that have some questions and observations. Lee asks, I understand that meetings are a place to connect and stay informed on what's happening in the organization, but it's frustrating sitting in a meeting where a large percent of the conversation doesn't relate to your work. And I think, Stephen Wogelberg, a lot of people can connect with that. And it's, you know, if you're in a workplace, it's hard to cover everyone's needs and areas of interest. And at the same time, you want to get people together to address some larger issues. How do we deal with that?
Well, I think it goes right back to the messaging from Dr. Neely is, you know, thinking through alternative mechanisms. If you don't require interaction, then leverage something else. Right. Leverage a different technology. You know, meeting size is so important. You know, meetings plummet in quality as size increases. You know, larger meetings are fake inclusion. Right? You think you're being inclusive by inviting people, but you're actually creating too large of a meeting such that people don't have airtime, and thus they don't participate as readily, and they often leave the meeting feeling like it was a waste of time. You know, interestingly, when we've studied these notions of meeting fatigue and Zoom fatigue, yeah, it's definitely associated with the sheer number of meetings and the lack of gaps between meetings. But ultimately, the big rocks that really move the dial on meeting fatigue and Zoom fatigue is by improving the quality of the meetings, by shrinking meeting times, by shrinking meeting sizes. That's the, you know, when people have meetings where they can truly engage and participate, magically, the fatigue doesn't seem to set in.
That's a knowing laugh from you, Sidal Neely. Here's a tweet from Steve. Did research on remote work look at whether the quality of a participant's on-camera appearance makes a difference? Did companies have trouble with participants who wouldn't turn on their video? Professor Neely, can I turn that back to you about remote meetings and just sort of the quality of how people look on a camera?
It's interesting. This is a very important question because the camera on versus camera off is typically a cultural element. In some organizations, people know to have their cameras on because it's modeled. It's what they've seen the leaders do. When it comes to our behaviors, they tend to be behaviors that we emulate from our leaders. This is true for any digital tools application. So the culture and the norms dictate those. And to have a conversation that requires people's input, people's engagement, people's nonverbal communication should be the ones where people would say, you know, would love to have everyone's camera on for this particular conversation. So to make those different from others where people are passively consuming some information that someone is sharing through a PowerPoint where their participation is not required. So the camera thing is a very big deal. The quality of the camera is a very big deal. Audio is a very big deal as well, by the way. One of the places where we have learned the most about proper camera behavior, proper audio behavior, believe it or not, has been through YouTube gamers. They've been pushing these technologies for a very long time. And in the last 14, 15 months, the rest of us have started to adopt some of those practices.
Steven Rogelberg, Sidal Neely just said the word PowerPoint. Do you have a short answer how you feel about PowerPoint presentations? Do they have their place?
Of course. They definitely have their place. But you know, it kind of goes back to the comment I made earlier, with 100 million meetings a day around the globe. And one of the things that's incredible is how similar all these meetings are. That leaders just kind of, you know, the amount of, or I should say the lack of thought, the lack of trying new things, doing different things, is just jarring. So what we really want meeting leaders to do is to mix it up. Right, to try different things to help build the energy, to help separate what people were doing before the meeting to what's currently at the meeting. So that can involve silence. That can involve not using PowerPoint. That could involve taking a page out of Amazon's book. And instead of asking people to prep before a meeting, you actually build meeting prep into the meeting itself. It could involve breakouts. There's just so many different tools and techniques that we can use. So any kind of blanket rule of thumb that, yeah, PowerPoint should be banned or PowerPoint should always be used is silly because everything has its place. And that's the tie back into stewardship. A steward actually thinks about the meeting before it occurs and makes choices.
Here's a tweet from Peter. I'm going to give this to you, Sidal Neely. Peter says, I have a difficult time staying focused during meetings and need to doodle and take notes to stay present, but some presenters find this distracting or think that I am not paying attention. What are your thoughts about that?
If you can make this an explicit piece for others, you know, I tend to doodle when I listen. Just get it out of the way and do what you need to do. Another issue we hear a lot about is neurodiversity. Some people who have a hard time concentrating with the camera on or they get headaches. I think to be able to share as much as you can with others that this is something that is important for you and just get it out of the way and move on with life. Otherwise, you're constantly worrying about what do they perceive I'm doing? Do they think I'm listening or not? But once you get it out of the way, you can just be yourself. But of course, you have to also demonstrate that you are listening through your contributions and your participations and not doodling the entire time. I wanted to also raise a point, though, about when meetings are incredibly important and necessary, and in fact, lots of them lots of sequence. And this is during onboarding, particularly virtual onboarding, when people join an organization and in this kind of remote work world, it's important not to leave them alone for a very long time. And in fact, for the first 3 weeks or more, you want them to have a plethora of meetings and connections with people so that they can feel a sense of the organization and they feel like they're not isolated and alone. This is a place, a discrete period where a lot of meetings are very important.
So if you're new to an organization, bring on the meeting so that you can meet everybody and get a sense of where you're working.
Exactly. And not even to be left alone for 3 weeks or more is what we're finding. And then get into some individual isolated work, but to really go intense and immersive on meetings. So there are great places for a ton of meetings, but not as an everyday way of work.
Let me just read one more comment. We got a lot of them, but here's one from Mercy. Why do meetings continue to increase in organizations? It sounds like there is resignation that meetings are here to stay and we all have to just suffer through and we all have to try to figure out how to make them more effective. Stephen Rogelberg, can you respond to that? We're almost out of time, but I just want to give you a chance to speak back.
Sure. So I'm going to go back to something you said earlier. If you ask people, you know, do they want to decrease meetings? They answer yes. But if you ask people, do you want voice? Do you want inclusion? The answer is also yes. And meetings are that mechanism for giving voice and creating a participatory environment. So, you know, what people crave is decreasing bad meetings, right, but increasing well-done meetings.
And a well-done meeting is about what? I should have probably asked this question an hour ago, but go ahead.
It's about a lot of things. You know, I think a well-done meeting is really about those compelling questions being answered in compelling ways so that people leave that meeting saying, that was a good use of time. And one of the things, you know, we've bashed on meetings pretty hard for good reason. But one of the things that we found in our research is that when leaders are more careful in the calling of meetings and they only call, you know, relevant meetings for the attendees, when meeting leaders are careful in managing time and when meeting leaders create voice in meetings, instead of meetings being places of drain, our research shows that meetings can actually be places of gain. A well-done meeting can create so many positive outcomes for an organization, for a team, and a leader.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. Stephen Rogelberg, Sidal Neely, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And again, Sidal Neely, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School, author of Remote Work Revolution, Succeeding from Anywhere. Stephen Rogelberg, professor of organizational science, psychology, and management at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, author of The Surprising Science of Meetings. And we appreciate all your questions and comments to Radio Times. If you want to carry on the conversation, you can certainly do that on our Facebook page. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.